All right, so welcome to the second part in of B'chol Dor V'Dor, in each and every generation, where we've been looking historically at how the Seder, how the Haggadah developed, how it came to be, how it evolved into what we have today. Last week, we began by looking at the Psukim in the Torah that describe Pesach, and they reveal the three core aspects of Pesach: Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. And they also introduce us to the idea and the importance of a group setting, and also the idea of education, the idea that it is important that children are aware of what is happening on Pesach night. And then we moved from the Torah, and we saw examples of Pesach being observed in other parts of Nach. And then we moved to the world of Bayit Sheni. So we looked at the apocryphal book of Jubilees, which talks about and describes Pesach, and it also mentions that on Pesach one drinks wine, and also says Hallel. And the other example, we talked about the most, perhaps the most famous Seder to have ever taken place, but it's not in a Jewish book. Many of the different books in the Christian Bible, I have a penchant personally for the book of Mark, it being my namesake, but talks about, once again, wine being drunk at the Seder and hymns being sung, in other words, Hallel, along with the group setting and other things. And so what we saw already in Bayit Sheni period was that there was more to Pesach night than just Pesach Matzah Maror, group setting, education. Also, wine and halal were involved. We don't know how much wine was drank. We don't know how much of halal was said, but you know what we would say is, you know, Torah Sheba Alpeh in action is already evident in some form or another in the Bayit Sheni period. And then what we spent a significant amount of time looking at last week were the Mishnayot of the 10th parak of Masechet Pesachim, or at least the first 8, which describe the Seder. And it goes through stage by stage the various aspects of what takes place at the Seder. For instance, we get Chazal codifying and bringing order. I mentioned last week, one way to try and understand Chazal is, the analogy is the Victorians and tennis. People were playing tennis for a long time before the Victorians came along and wrote the rules to tennis, but they kind of came along and they concretized, you know, a series of rules. This is how it works, you know. What I call football, you call soccer, work the same way. You have laws being written in order to codify and bring order to what's taking place. And that's what happened with Chazal in these Mishnayot. So we go from wine is drunk to 4 cups of wine are drunk. And we saw so many different aspects of the Seder start to come about in the Mishnayot. 4 cups of wine, charoset was introduced. And the idea of eating a meal we looked at last week and will, I think we'll return to today. The idea that, no, we won't return it to today, I just wanted to mention it because I mentioned it last week. The idea that originally perhaps the Seder was a meal, and during the meal, you did maggot. So something that we looked at last week, which is one of those really cool things to see inside the Mishnah, is we do manage Shana all wrong. The way the Mishnah in the 4th Mishnah in the 10th parak of Masechet Pesachim lists manage Shana, it's, these are the questions the father asks his child if the child doesn't know what's going on. And, you know, I said last week, I have a 3.5-year-old, that is literally what you have to do. Point out all the obvious things. That's why they're such basic questions. It's because you are supposed to point out to your child, have you not noticed? Usually we eat chametz. Tonight we're not spotting any pattern here. Usually we don't eat bitter things. But, you know, they are questions not for the child to ask their parents, but for the parents to ask their children. And again, Manishana, I was talking about this with a friend over the weekend, Manishana kind of only makes sense if the meal's already begun at that point. Because otherwise, you know, nowadays, fine, children are trained to know what to expect, so they ask the questions anyway. But if these are, again, the guiding questions you're supposed to ask as an educational, you know, programming, then you need to be in a situation where you are eating these things or not eating these things, doing these things, not doing these things, in order to point it out. So we saw kind of how the Seder progressed in the times of the Mishnah, which may have been in a slightly different inverted order than what we do nowadays. We, yes?
What was it called before there was a Seder? Did that
mean?
I mean, if it wasn't 10 different things that we were supposed to be...
Oh, is it? Great question. Hold that question because we're going to see something that doesn't answer the question but kind of answers the question in a few seconds when we turn to the source sheet. But we also see the kind of the beginning of Magid begin to crystallize. So for instance, the Mishnah, and this is important to help us understand what we're going to see today, the Mishnah mentions a ton of different principles. So it says, Matchil beginut u'mesayim b'shevach. You begin with the disgrace of the Jewish people, and you end, you conclude with their praise, with their glory. It says, you doresh me arami oved avi, from the verse, my father was a wandering Aramean, until the end of the passage, and you elaborate upon that. We got the brachot of the Seder, Gaal Yisrael, the exact wording. We got certain texts that are part of our Haggadah to this day, Lefichach. Anachnu chayivim, you know, whatever we say in the Haggadah, it slips my mind to say the whole passage off by heart, but you get the idea. It's in there. Hallel, the break we do at Hallel, is if you think of the Seder for a second, we break Hallel after the first two Pirkei Tehillim. That's in there too, already in the Mishnayot. And the Mishnayot also says, for example, Ein maftirin achahar pesach afikomen, that after you've eaten your pesach, you don't have an afikomen. Now, this brings us to what we're going to look at for a lot of today, which is how the Amoraim interpreted the Mishnayot. So again, the Amoraim come after the Tanaim of the Mishnah, and a lot of the things the Mishnah takes for granted, as we will see, the Amoraim don't necessarily know what it's talking about. It makes, so for example, as we're going to see, the Mishnah says, Matchil beginut u'mesayim b'shevach. Begin with the degradation of the Jewish people and end with their praise. And, you know, the assumption is, you know what that is. You know what that means. But suddenly, you know, the Amoraim are sat in Bavel and they're like, what does this mean? Like, seriously, has anyone heard anything? What did they do? You know, the analogy you might think of, and again, apologies if probably no one else likes this sport, but again, if soccer disappeared off the face of this earth and no one knew anything about it, save like a few brief, you know, like random articles, all of a sudden we'd have to piece together, if we wanted to reconstruct the sport based on what we have, but it makes a lot of, now I'm mixing inside baseball, or, you know, should have used baseball as the example because of inside baseball, but you get the idea. The Mishnah references things that by the time Chazal are in Bavel, they don't know. We are going to see one brilliant example of this. It uses a language they no longer speak. It uses Greek. And the problem is that if you don't speak Greek, which they don't by the time they're in Bavel, you don't have a clue what they're meaning, and you have to make a lot of educated guesses, which we'll see. So what we are going to see today are really brief excerpts from the 10th, again, Perek Yud, the 10th Perek of Masechet Pesachim, which deals with Seder night. In theory, we could comb through the entirety of that Perek and find a ton of really interesting things, but we don't have the time to do that because when I was in Yeshiva, one of the Rabbonim did a record speed read-through of that Gemara, and he took 2 hours, so we don't have time to comb through and observe. So instead, we're just going to look at highlights, and we're going to see how not only does the Haggadah start to gain more and more of its form that we have today, but we're also going to see that so much of its form today is driven by the central question, which is, what is the Mishnah talking about? What exactly is it? If you think of the, you know, for example, something we're not going to dwell on, but for instance, you come a lot in the 10th parak of Masech Pesachim, a lot of, what's this? So, my carapace. What is it? What is carapace? And they try and figure it out. Because as an assumption, people used to know what this was. But now no one does anymore. I have my analogy. This morning, we have a 3.5-year-old. I'm English. My wife is American. We're dropping off Yair at Maimo today. And his teacher turns to me and she's like, is dummy the English word for pacifier? And I'm like, yeah. She's like, okay, good. Because like the other day, for whatever reason, there was a picture of a pacifier in the classroom. And Yair screams out, dummy. And everyone's like, that's not a nice word to say. And then someone else in the, you know, one of the, you know, the other teacher in the room was like, I think that's what they call it in England. So, you know, so think of that, like, the Mishnah is screaming dummy into the classroom and everyone else is like, huh? What is that? We don't know what it is. You need someone to translate. And so much of this Gemara, and indeed many Gemara, are motivated simply by, what is the Mishnah trying to say? Let's try and piece it together based on what we've heard, based on what we've heard other people try and say, based on its internal logic. And so we are going to see many examples of that today. and it leads to some really, really cool, fascinating conclusions about what our Haggadah looks like and what our Haggadah does not look like. But let's begin with source number one. So last week, Felice asked a question, which was, is the Haggadah physical? Like, at which point does the Haggadah become a physical text? And I mentioned to her that my friend was going to be here for Shabbat, who, like, this is kind of his wheelhouse. And I had to listen to the 30-minute lecture on it. But basically, the Haggadah is one of the most manuscripted things we have. And we have more copies of the Haggadah than anything else. So we know from, you know, in the Cairo Geniza, we know from very early on, it was a text. But what we already see in the Gemara, in our the first source is purely to prove this point, and the second source it comes up also, if you take a look at source number one, which is from the Gemara in Pesachim, as basically every single one of our sources comes from, it says the following, Amar Rav Acha bar Yaakov, Suma Pata Milome Haggadah. A blind person is exempt from reading the Haggadah. We're not going to get into why, but what we see here is, the Haggadah is a concept already in the times of the Amoraim. They are talking about the notion of a Haggadah. So this idea, and this kind of goes to your question, this idea that Seder night has gone from being something everyone's just doing to something that has some sort of Seder, for want of a better expression, some sort of routine, some sort of, you know, I try not to use synonyms for Seder and order, but some sort of thing to it, they're already speaking about a Haggadah. They are already speaking. Now, does that mean, is that the Maxwell? No, it's not the Maxwell House Haggadah, but it is some sort of known form of thing that people do on Seder night. And if you take a look at source number two, and I more or less try to, though I think I fail at some point, try to go in somewhat chronological order of like, how the Seder comes together, you know, what Chazal add to it here. So if you take a look at source number two, it says the following. Amar Rav Shimi bar Ashi, Matzah lifnei kol echad ve'echad. Put matzah in front of everyone. Maror lifnei kol echad ve'echad. Ve'charoset lifnei kol echad vo'echad. And again, put matzah, maror, everyone gets their own matzah, their own maror, their own charoset. Rav Huna Omer, Kulahu Name Lifne Misha Omer Haggadah. They only go in front of the guy who's actually reading the Haggadah, who's leading the Seder. V'hel Chatoka Rav Huna, and the Gemara adds, well, the actual halacha goes according to Rav Huna. So first of all, different people do different things. Some families do have where everyone has their own Seder plate. And some people have where only one person. And apparently the Gemara thinks that's a pretty, you know, conclusive thing. But we have here the proto-Seder plate. Part of the discussion that motivates this is the idea of like accessibility of mitzvah objects without kind of going over the idea that we don't want to kind of pass over another mitzvah object in order to use another mitzvah object. But we have here the idea of the Seder plate. When we think of the core logistic of the Seder, before the Seder even begins, we set it up. And we set it up in such a way, and we don't even really think about this anymore because we just look at the picture inside the Haggadah. But there's a logistical challenge to do, which is how do we put all of the ritual items we need at the Seder in the most accessible place possible for the person leading the Seder, and so that they're not going to be moving their hands over things that they, you know, because the idea is if you are trying to take the matzah, you shouldn't be putting your hand over the maror, because the maror is also used for a mitzvah object, and you don't want to kind of put your hand over one mitzvah object to get another. But we see here the debate already in the times of Chazal is, how do we set up the Seder plate? How do we divvy up? Does just one person get all the matzot? Or does every single person around the Seder, it probably wasn't a table in those days, but does everyone, you know, present at the Seder, get their own? So we already see another, something that was not discussed in the Mishnayot, that was taken for a given, and no one even, you know, discusses it. Suddenly the Gemara is discussing it. Rav Huna is a second generation Amora. So he comes, you know, based on second generation Amora, you can, you know, his distance from the Tanaim, and this is already being concretized in his time, but it's already a debate in his time. The Seder plate. Nowadays, again, depending on, I would say it's in the front of the Haggadah, but depending on which Haggadah you have, it will be a different picture because of the halachic debate surrounding what the Seder plate should look like. But it finds its genesis right here in the Gemara when Chazal start to, you know, bring greater clarity to what the Seder looks like. If you take a look at source number 3, from the exact same daf in the Gemara, we have another ritual very prevalent at the Seder that we take for granted, that the Gemara, you know, and again, a lot of these are selections from the Gemara in which there is a broader debate surrounding it. So this is not the only conclusive line, this is part of a broader discussion. Adivrei Rav Chista l'Ravana Ukva. Rav Chista authorized Ravana Ukva to teach Vedarash. Natal Yadav B'Tibol Rishon, Natal Yadav B'Tibol Sheni. You wash your hands for the first dipping, you should wash your hands for the second. The concept basically here is, we wash our hands at the beginning of the Seder, does that cover everything or not? So we wash our hands twice at the Seder. There's also debate whether we should wash it 3 times because of the obligation of Mayim Acharonim, of washing your hands before benching, which we don't tend to observe nowadays. But we see here again, what's the debate? When does the hand washing come in? So again, they're figuring out the Seder song at this point. You know, we have, you know, Orchats, but, you know, but how many times do we wash our hands? How many times are we actually, you know, washing our hands during the Seder? So again, we've got our Seder plate. We had our Kaddish, we had our 4 cups of wine already from the Mishnah, but now we also have our 2 different hand washings being seen as being integral to the Seder.
So is the first hand washing for Karpas
yes.
something that everybody does or just the leader?
So I can't remember every single aspect of all the details, but technically you wash before touching vegetables in general, but we don't. But on the Seder night we do.
So, yeah, I was reading about this recently. It actually has to do with if you are dipping something in a liquid that's makabel tuma.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's, yeah.
Fruit and vegetables, when they get wet, become makabel tuma. They can contract ritual impurity, so you want to wash your hands. Now, usually those things don't bother us, but on Seder night, when we are trying to reenact a ritual that was suffused with ritual purity because there was a korban, there was the Pesach sacrifice at its center, we are far more Zecher l'Mikdash. We do far, far more things in order to remind us of life inside the Beit HaMikdash. So yeah, we wash our hands for that reason. But the question is, you know, how much does it cover? I hear it seems to be, you know, the second dipping is actually the marrow into the Charoset, which we don't seem to observe. But fundamentally, this idea that you wash your hands more than once at the Seder is an idea that comes to the fore here. And again, brings great, in the times of the Mishnah, the question that hangs at the back of this that we there's no real answer to give for some of these was in the times of the Mishnah, was this just a given and they just knew and Chazal are now trying to piece it back together, or are Chazal kind of being like, well, hold on a second, now we need to start doing all of this because as we've brought more laws, you know, into the fold, as we've kind of, you know, codified more and more aspects of how Jews live their lives, we now need to start applying these laws to these new situations that in previous eras might just have been taken for granted.
So everybody would have washed.
Everybody would wash. Yes.
I think today, in a lot of places, it's just the
interesting. I have always... It's one of those things where if you go to a Seder not like your own, you spot the differences. But in both my Sedarim and my wife's family's Sedarim, everyone washes. But there's lots of other things we do very differently. Like my wife's family do lots of Seder plates, whereas mine only does one. So yeah, interesting. Interesting that only the... That would make sense because usually the Seder leader's doing the dipping, but then everyone's holding wet celery, which is not a... nice mental image. The core, really, what I love about piecing together the Haggadah as we get to the times of the Gemara, really starts to come to the fore now. In that so much of the core aspect of the Haggadah that we will read reflects an inability to weigh in on a debate in the Gemara itself. So as I mentioned last week in source number 4, again we see it, the excerpt from the Mishnah here, Matchil Bignut Umesayim B'Shevach. You begin by talking about how do you answer Manish Tana? How do you begin Magid proper? Talk about the disgrace of the Jewish people and end with their praise. What does that mean? So first we take a look at the Yerushalmi. And the Yerushalmi gives us the view of Rav. Rav Amar, Matchila Tsarich Lahatchil. Ve'eva harnahar yeshvu avotechem, vo'ekachet avichem et Avraham me'eva harna'a va'arbe. You must start by quoting these other psukim from Sefer Yehoshua right at the beginning, as Yehoshua is kind of recounting the history of the Jewish people. You begin with, your forefathers used to worship idols, but I took your forefather Avraham out from beyond that area, and I multiplied his offspring and I made him great. There we have. We have the disgrace of the Jewish people. Their forefathers, their ancestors, our ancestors were all idolaters. And the praise is, you know, Avraham, and we were made great, and God kept his promise, and everything is wonderful. That is all the Yerushalmi says in explaining Matchil Beginut Umesayim B'Shevach. However, the Gemara, the Bavli, gives not only the view of Rav, but also the view of Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel are the two major rabbinic figures of their generation. And source number 6 says, Matchil Beginut Umesayim B'Shevach, Mai Beginut. So again, we have that language that we come across so often, which is the, huh? What is it? Mai Beginut. The Yerushalmi takes it more as a grunter, like this is what it is, but the Bavli is more explicit, like what is Gnut? Rav Amar, Matchila Ovdei Avodat Gilulim Hayu Avotenu, our forefathers were idolaters. Shmuel Amar, Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves. Now you see kind of the two different, you know, ends of the story. If we're beginning with the disgrace of the Jewish people, Rav says you begin with, in the beginning our forefathers were idolaters. Shmuel says no, you begin with Avadim Hayinu and God took us out. That's kind of the praise. Shmuel only cares about the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Rav takes a more, you know, broader approach to God's hand in our lives by starting all the way back in, you know, before Avraham appears on the scene and ending with a more major aspect of Judaism, which is God fulfilling his promises. Now, does anyone know what we do in the Haggadah? Which view do we follow? So, really.
Rav.
What makes you think we do Rav? Yeah, so you are both right. How do we begin Mashna? Avadim Hayinu Lefarba Mitzrayim, Ozenim, blah, 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 blah. And then, after we complete that section, you will notice we then switch and we were like, Matchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu. We follow both opinions. Now, I mentioned last week that the Mishnah debates how one does Hallel, and admittedly it's a binary debate because you can't fulfill both opinions, but the Haggadah completely ignores. The Haggadah completely ignores the view of Beit Shammai, which kind of makes sense because that's usually what we do, and it's a binary opinion. But here, the Haggadah, with just a few rabbinic generations later, when we have a debate between Rav and Shmuel, the Haggadah doesn't want to weigh in. It does both. And personally, if you've ever, you know, the nice Divrei Torah you should give at a Seder offer nice reasons why we say these things. But there's something nice about the internal logic as to why it actually found its way into there in the first place. So Avadim Hayinu makes a lot of sense. We don't even question that, but like, why do we suddenly break from that into Matchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayo? Why do we suddenly start talking about our ancestors were idolaters? Like, fine, it's nice, but it's because Rav thought that's what Matchila Bignut Umesayim B'Shevach. One interesting thing to kind of question is the Yerushalmi, and we're going to see an example of this where it is clear. The Yerushalmi sometimes has a better handle on the world of the Mishnah because the Yerushalmi didn't move that far away. It gets the context of the Mishnah because it still remained in the land of Israel. And therefore the Yerushalmi, whereas the Bavli will have 15,000 views on a topic, the Yerushalmi sometimes just has one because it's like, this is what it is. There's no reason to like, and part of it is, you know, there's more reasons than just that, but Matchila Beginut Umesayim B'Shevach, maybe the Yerushalmi knows something the Bavli does not about the original intent of the Mishnah. Maybe it was take a broader, you know, broader view of Jewish history than just Yitziat Mitzrayim. Extrapolate from Yitziat Mitzrayim into other aspects of our Jewish lives and God's hand in our lives, whereas Shmuel is much narrower, but in the Haggadah we do both, which personally I think is really cool, and it also helps explain why we do both in the Haggadah, because it's a debate, and we don't want it. We don't have the advantage like we had in source number two of Vehilchata Karav Huna. The Gemara never says Vehilchata Kashmul. We follow the view of Shmuel. And therefore, for this reason, in our Haggadah to this day, in our Haggadah these days, we follow both opinions, though we will see some evidence that not everyone was following those opinions in previous eras of Jewish history. We were slaves. Yes, but the way what Shmuel is defining Gnut and Shevach, degradation and praise, to be, degradation and glory, degradation is slaves, glory is free. So those are two opposites, whereas for Rav, its degradation is we worshipped idols, and our praise is we worshipped God. So they do flip around each other, like we were slaves, we are now free. Though, you know, that is, you know, a pretty good reason. Pretty good reason to celebrate. It fundamentally, you know, motivates the Seder. But, you know, it does opposite itself. But it's not as epic as Rav's view. Rav's view is far grander an interpretation of these two terms. And it's about our relationship to God. Whereas Shmuel's view is far more just like, almost, you know, it's historical. I mean, it's also about God because he took us out. But it's about, you know, we were once slaves, no one wants to be a slave, and now we're free, yay. Whereas Rav's is far grander. Does anyone know what happens after we do Matchila of Dei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu in the Haggadah? No one else, like, has already internalized the Haggadah off by heart? Come on, it's like 2 weeks to Pesach. What else do you read on Shabbat during laning? No, we don't. Broadly speaking, we have a few other things. We have a story. Now that comes, we have a story. We have a story, we have a Mishnah, and we have... So the Mishnah is about Kriyat Shema. The story is about... And we mentioned it last week, as it's a story that occurs on the Tosefta, but does not... But it's completely different to the Haggadah. The story of the sages in B'nai Brak. There are five sages in B'nai Brak, and they are talking all about Yitziat Mitzrayim until someone has to come. So I mentioned last week that story is already found in the Tosefta, except they're not in B'nai Brak, they're in Lod. None of the stuff that happens in that story happens. It's really weird. It's almost as though the Haggadah took a story and completely rewrote it for the Haggadah. The question is why? Why do we have a story that's completely rewritten? It follows then with a Mishnah, which is source number 7. Which if you read, you'll start to... This is the point of the Haggadah where you're really like, why is this in here? It's a Mishnah from Masechet Brachot. It has kind of core relevance to Pesach, but it's really talking about every single day, and it says the following. Mazkirin Yitziat Mitzrayim ba'leilot. We should mention Yitziat Mitzrayim at night. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, hare ani kaven shivim shana. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, I'm like a 70-year-old man. And I always wanted to be able to prove that we do have to recall Yitzhak Mitzrayim at night, but I could never do so until Ben Zoma came along. Shneema, and he derived it from Lema'an Tizkor Yom Tzeitcha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Kol Yumecha Yecha. The Pasuk says, in order that you remember the day when you left Egypt for all the days of your life, you don't need the word kol there. It's unnecessary. So Yemei Chayecha Hayamim. Yemei Chayecha is talking about the Yamim. Kol Yemei Chayecha Halelot. The kol adds, gives us the principle that we also learn it at night. V'chachamim Omrim Yemei Chayecha Olam Hazeh. Kol Yemei Chayecha Lavi Limot HaMashiach. The Chachamim learn something different, that we'd still recall Yitzhak Mitzrayim in the days of Mashiach. That's a Mishnah from Masechet Brachot, which proves to us the obligation to learn, to recall Yitzhak Mitzrayim at night. Why do we mention it, the Seder? Because the Seder is at night. Yeah. The story of the sages in B'nai Brak teaches us the importance of, it's kind of like, it's an inspirational story. Now, like a lot of inspirational stories, it's completely made up, but based in a kind of a kernel of truth is that once were people who were in another location talking about something and something happened, but fundamentally it's, you know, it's like a lot of, you know, inspirational stories in both the Jewish world and the outside world. It has maybe a kernel of truth, but fundamentally it's a lie. And the story of the sages of Bnei Brak is there to teach us fundamentally, look at all these guys. This is the elite, the top tier of the rabbinic world, and if they could spend the whole night talking about Yetziat Mitzrayim and they know everything already, you should do too. It's an inspirational story because, remember, Arami Oved Avi, which is going to come up next, the pesukim that we are supposed to darshan, the pesukim that we're supposed to delve into and elaborate on, that's coming up next, so we're getting ourselves excited. And we're giving ourselves a little kick of inspiration where, you know, we're getting a nice story about people who did this, even though they really could have gotten away without doing it, in order to prove to ourselves we have to do it too.
When they brought Korban Pesach,
it was during the day. Well, the sacrifice, it's eaten at night, but it's killed during the day.
So why would there even be a question that you're not
going to
do there at night?
So it's a great question. The only, you know, the question is, you may think that you're going to try and get away with not doing this now. We get our little inspirational story, and then we get our little, oh, and by the way, here's the point where I tell you, you actually have to do it. I don't give drashot like this, but I could imagine giving drashot like this, where on a Shabbat morning, I start with a nice inspirational story, which tells people why they should do X, and then, oh, by the way, here's an explicit rule why you have to do X. You know, you actually have no excuses. The inspiration was, you know, to try and work, but it's carrot and stick. So you could argue that Haggadah is using a bit of carrot and stick here in, here's an inspirational story followed by no excuses. You can't actually claim, but it's nighttime. You didn't talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim at nighttime. We'll do it tomorrow when we're awake. No, here's a Mishnah. It says otherwise. You can't get away with that. There is a of many, I'm sure, beautiful Divrei Torah, one beautiful Divrei Torah I really like on this Mishnah, I think I mentioned it last year when I did a different Divrei Torah one can give at the Seder. Rav Yosef Rimon points out that one of the main themes of the Seder is obviously children and our willingness to listen to children's, you know, questions and children's answers. So he points out that Ben Zoma in the ranking of Chazal members at this point in his life is like, he's very young compared to Rav Elazar Ben Azaria, who the Mishnah emphasizes is like, you know, he's the lead guy. He's one of the people who heads the Beit Midrash. You know, and then we have Ben Zoma, and he could never figure out something. And then Ben Zoma came along and proved it to him. Ah, listen to young people sometimes when they have a suggestion because they're very often right. And you know, and it's a nice Divrei Torah, and it's definitely very true. And again, people may prefer that to, why are we reading this Mishnah? So you don't have an excuse. Now let's keep on learning. The next thing we get is the four sons. Keneged Arba Banim Dibra Torah. We aren't going to talk about that now, because that's going to be my Shabbat Hagadol Drasha. Is going to be, Keneged Arba Banim Dibra Torah. The Torah speaks of four sons, but it doesn't. And we are going to explore, first of all, where it comes from in the Torah and the fact that if you look in every single, basically, it's both the kind of secret part four to this series, but its own independent thing. But like, if you look at kind of the literature of Chazal, the list of four is very different. Some of them have different names. The questions are assigned to different people. So we'll be unpacking that more and more. So we're not going to touch the four sons there. But similarly, Arami Oved Avi we will talk about next week. As I mentioned, next week we will look at two examples. One example is how the Haggadah shaped a major aspect of Jewish philosophy and Jewish thought. Arami Oved Avi will be a major component of that. And we will also look at how we, in the 20th century, basically completely changed the interpretation of one of the central aspects of the Haggadah, which is something we'll talk about next week. So just kind of those are the two outstanding aspects of Maggid that aren't going to be covered. Arami Oved Avi we'll talk about next week in better detail, because again, at this point, the Doreshme Arami Oved Avi is still taken as for granted, because if you are a member of Chazal, you know what it means to be Doresh Pasuk. That is literally what you do. You expound Pasukim. We've already seen in Mishnah 7, in Source 7, how one is, you know, how one darshans a verse, what one learns from it. So Chazal didn't really need to figure out what that is. But we start to get some really, really further, fascinating examples of how the Seder took shape, based in part on the fact that Chazal weren't necessarily 100% clear on what the Mishnah was saying. Source number 8. We're talking about Haseba. After a long discussion about when one reclines and when one does not recline at the Seder, Parakadan, if you lie on your back, Losham ya Haseba. Hasebat Yamin, Losham Haseba. If you lie on your right, that's not Haseba. Velo od elashama yakdir mekona leveshet viavili de sakana. Also, it could cause you to choke, and that's not going to be good. Now, the Yerushalmi doesn't have any discussion of what Haseba is because it knows what it looks like. In the Bavli, they're like, what is this? That's leaning. That's not leaning. No, that's not leaning either. You only have to define something so explicitly when you're not quite sure what it is. The Mishnah knows what Haseba is. And by the way, it's not this. This is not Haseba. No one in the history of the world until 20th century Jewry ever thought this was reclining. It's not leaning. There's actually, I have a large rant to this. It's actually from my Rebbe, Rabbi Jeremy Weider, who's one of the Rosh Yeshiva of YU. He points out that reclining is lying on your left, Roman style. If you are sitting and just leaning to the left, that's not reclining. If you look in early versions of the Shulchan Aruch, it says Yesev, and at some point a printer changes it to Yeshev, to sit, which is how people derive the idea that it involves sitting. So, you know, basically no one ever actually fulfills Haseba at their Seder, which is why, fortunately, there is the view of the Rav Yah, I forget what his actual name was, one of the medieval halakhic authorities, who says nowadays, if you sit like this, this is how kings sit, so it's perfectly acceptable. And so, basically, if you aren't going to have an old-style Seder, where you're actually going to be lying down and reclining, everyone, whether they like it or not, is basically relying on the view of the Rav Yah, whether they're doing this or this. Also, Rav Soloveitchik thought this was absolute nonsense, which isn't surprising. He thought you had to twist your chair and like lean into it because it's more recliningy. But the point is, why don't any of us know what reclining is? Why do we all do this? Because we don't recline. I mean, we lounge. We lounge nowadays, and that's basically what it is. But in the Roman times, everyone knew what knew what Haseba was because that's how you sat. That was how the wealthy people ate. They reclined. But by the time we get to Bavel, no, the Yerushalmi lives in a world where reclining is still a thing. In Bavel, it's not. In Bavel, they're like, what is this? So they're like, when do you do it? When don't you? Because it's unnatural. Before this whole discussion here, we have the, well, you do it for this and you don't do it for this. Again, the Yerushalmi is like, you recline, because how else does one sit at the Seder? But the Bavli is like, okay, we're all in chairs or whatever they're doing at that point. Like, when do we do it? When don't we do it? What does it look like? It's not on your back. No, that's not. And you can almost imagine them, and I don't mean to kind of be diminishing the greatness of Chazal. You can imagine them all just like sitting in a room looking at someone like trying out different poses and then being like, no, that's not going to work. That could kill you. That's not going to be Haseba. Come on, let's get some consensus here. And eventually they conclude reclining on your left is what you do. Remember, not for naught do we often find in the Gemara a story of someone comes from the land of Israel and actually teaches them what it is. And they're like, oh, that's what it is now. And that, you know, that is a common, relatively frequently occurring trope in the Gemara. Rav Dimi arrives from Eretz Yisrael and he's like, what are you doing? It's this. You know, that is, but again, it's, you know, just like we nowadays are just as guilty. You know, I mean, in this shul is a great example where this is a shul from 1912 that was founded by a set of members, most of whom, you know, some of their grandchildren are connected to the shul, but they have at best patchy memories of, you know, how their grandparents acted. And we've kind of re-come into the shul and we're like, what did they do? And we're just like, maybe, like, and we find evidence, like, this is Nusach Sfarad Shul, but like, we know they were using Nusach Ashkenaz Machzor and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, because those are the only things with English Hebrew translation. So it's like, what were they doing? And we need someone to come out of a time machine and be like, this is what we did. And we'll be like, that all makes so much sense now. But because that's not going to happen, we don't have our own Rav Dimi. We're trying to reconstruct things based on what we think, you know, how things worked. That's what Chazal are doing too.
So this looks smart with Yiddish pronouncements.
So yeah, that is about the fine if you smoke. And some people have translated it in the past.
It's language is one sentence.
Or too many misadventures.
Yeah, so, you know, we have, and the classic is the poster of George Washington, which used to be a big thing in Boston shuls, and now this is like the only shul that, yeah, someone told me that. Someone who, like, not even from our shul. So it was not like they were trying to explain why someone wants to stick up a poster of George Washington. Like, someone who was like, this is a thing, and this is, like, the only shul that still has it up there, which is why we never replaced it with the rest of George Washington.
You don't know what's important to record until it's too late.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, again, the Mishnah, the best example of this you will ever come across, and I spoke about this at length last year, the Kazayit, the olive. If you are Chazal, you're like, we need something everyone will always know what it looks like. An olive. Olives are everywhere. And then you get to, and if you look, and Rabbi Nathan Slifkin has written at length on this, if you look at the halachic discussion of the Kazayit, everyone living in a part of the world which had olives is just like, Kazayit. And if you're the Baalei Tosafot living in northern France, freezing, you're like, what's an olive? And you're like, I guess it's, and they use really brilliant guesstimations to try and figure out what be this thing they are describing. But fundamentally, they can only try and, the Rambam doesn't try and figure out what an olive is because he's eating one as he's writing it. You know, so again, you, it's not even you don't know what's important to record, but you don't realize what people won't know. You don't realize just what things everyone takes as a given. And again, we're going to come up to one of the best examples of this where the Mishnah uses Greek. It doesn't think people won't know Greek because it doesn't think of a world in which maybe people will forget Greek. Maybe people will forget things and won't remember what it is anymore. And so so much of the project of Chazal and the Gemara is let's try and figure out what they are saying. And often using very, very brilliant solutions. And often they are relying on the authority. You know, it's the reason why there's so much authority of past generations is because the belief is if I heard it from, you know, so-and-so, you know, we live in a city which is very influenced by the view of Rav Soloveitchik, but we have now moved further and further from people who actually knew what he did, you know, what his practices were in the shul. And so you're relying on people who tell you what people told you they actually saw him doing back in the 60s. And fine, we still have a lot of the institutional memory because it's not such a long period of time. But you see, you know, how things work. Yeah. People don't remember. And people start to just be like, you know, maybe he did this. You know, there's a lot of debate over what exactly was, you know, Rav Soloveitchik's position on X because we just don't know. Because it wasn't a concern or a question at the time. And so we never explicitly dealt with it. That's kind of the issue facing Chazal.
Number 8, their anatomy is all wrong. You can't put the esophagus in front of
it. Yeah, so I'll admit it's also it's a bad translation. But yeah, it's about how you'll eat, it will, you know. But yeah. Okay. Yeah. Source number 9 is one of the most famous things we do at the Seder and also one of the most famous examples of kind of a transformation of something. The Gemara says, after again, so it has a whole debate, first of all, on what did Hillel do? Which is not in the source sheet, where it's like, someone's like, you can't wrap the matzah and marrow and Pesach together, and someone's like, Hillel did it, and they're like, no, he didn't. And then there's a whole debate over what did Hillel actually do, until we actually settle on, no, he actually did it. He made essentially a kind of shawarma, because remember, matzahs were more laugh-alike probably in those days. My brother-in-law always likes to wish, you know, one could get away with having a shawarma at the Seder, and it would make for a very different experience. But the Gemara says, Hashta, d'lo itamar hilchata lo kehilal v'lo k'rabanan. So the Rabbanan argue that you should splice it. You have matzah, and then you have marrow. And Hillel's like, no, you wrap them all together and eat them as one. Because we don't know which one to do, Mevarich al achilat matzah v'achil. Make your bracha on the matzah and eat. V'hada mevarich al achilat maro. Then make your bracha on maro and v'achil and eat it. V'hada achil matzah v'chasa v'hadi hadadi below bracha. Then eat the two of them together without a bracha. Zecha l'mikdash kehilal. You know, in remembrance of how things were done in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, as Hillel used to do. So we get our mitzvah of matzah, we get our mitzvah of maror, and then we remember a time when things might have been done differently by following the view of Hillel. It used to be, and again, a lot of this comes from the Haggadah of the Sages by the Safrai family. It used to be that if you look at kind of old Haggadahs, they say, the passage Zecha l'mikdash kehillel, this was what Hillel did. It used to be just a little kind of note, an explanation as to why you're doing this, why we're following the Gemara. And at some point, it transforms into a passage we all recite. But there's, you know, and part of the reason might be because we don't make a bracha before it, and we've made bracha before the rest of it. We need to kind of do something beforehand. So we all hold it up, and we're like, this is what Hillel did. You know, he would do this now. But, like, you don't actually, that's not, like, a thing.
You're reading the stage directions in a script.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. You are, and there's other examples of, you know, we don't, but, you know, some people do read out loud the stage directions of the Seder. But basically, that's what we all do nowadays. And it was like, literally, it was just like, let's justify why we're doing this. But now we don't ever say stuff before foods that aren't brachot. But at the Seder, we suddenly do. And it's an example of how it's kind of transformed probably just by people just doing it. And maybe in order to explain it out loud to everyone else, but, like, everyone reads it, like, ritually, like, together at a lot of Siddharim, and it's like, there's no need, like, it's not a bracha, it's not a read everyone together, it's just a, it fits better with, like, you know, a section of Maggid, which, you know, again, different people might do different things at Siddharim, but, you know, either you have one person reading everything out loud, or you go around the room and different people say something. Zechel HaMikdash Hillel fits the Maggid section more, as in one person should just read it, and then everyone eats it because we don't need it, but the stage direction has become, it's, oh my goodness, what's that famous scene of the actor? Is it a Hercules movie where he's angry? Oh, this is the best. No one's seen this. It's an amazing scene from an actual movie where the actor is like, frustrated! Because he read his stage direction as a piece of his script. And so he screams frustrated in a frustrated tone, not realizing that he was just supposed to roar frustratedly, not actually say the thing. That's basically what we do with Zechel HaMikdash Kehillel. I can't remember the details, but you can YouTube, with enough YouTube Google, you'll find it yourself. It's an amazing, you know, thing to look at. That's basically what we do with the Haggadah. My favorite example of this, the best example of this, and maybe the coolest thing possible about the Haggadah comes in source number 10. So remember, we read in the Mishnah last week, Ein Matirin Acha HaPesach Afikomen. You can't have an Afikomen after the Pesach. To which the Gemara asks, my Afikomen. What is an Afikomen? It's a kind of spoiler. It's not a Hebrew word or an Aramaic word. Amar Rav. Rav says, now remember, who was Rav last, when did we last encounter Rav? With Shmuel, but when was Rav counted solely by himself? By what? The Yerushalmi, which tends to have a better handle on things. So we could at this point, and this is, we're going to see is true, Rav, for whatever reason, has a better handle on these things than anyone else. But anyway, Rav, Shalo Ya'akru Mechabura Lechabura. They don't move from one group to another. Very confusing. But again, remember in the times of, you know, when people would eat the Korban Pesach in groups, what he's saying is that Afikoman is about don't get up and move from one group to another and have just like a whole social afterwards. It's like stay in your group. Stay in your designated group. Even when you finish the Korban Pesach, you think the Seder's over, stay in your group. Don't get up and just, you know, kind of like at a big social, but like you get up from your table after the main meal and you walk over and sit at another table. Don't do that. Very confusing, seems to be completely different to what we do nowadays, and completely different to how everyone else interprets it. Ushmuel amar, and Shmuel says, Kagon ar ordilai li velagulizela la'aba. Shmuel says, for, you know, an example of an afikomen are mushrooms for me, and pigeons for Abba. V'rav chanina bar shila v'rabi yochanan amar, kagon tamarim kalayot ve'egozim. Rabbi Chanina, and Rabbi Yochanan both say, dates, parched ears of corns, and nuts. Tanya coveted Rabbi Yochanan. We found a Tosefta, a source that seems to prove Rabbi Yochanan correct. Ein maftirin acha har pesach, kagon tamarim, kalayot ve'egozim. For example, with dates, parched ears, and nuts. According to Rav, afikomen is about getting up and moving around. Which seems nonsense when everyone else is like, it's some sort of delicacy or dessert. And indeed, what's the rule after the afikomen? The afikomen is dessert. You don't eat anything afterwards. That's what an afikomen is. It's dessert and we don't eat, you know, the halacha is we don't eat anything after the afikomen. The taste have to remain in our mouth. Now, if you take a look at source number 7, Shaul Lieberman, who is, you know, the best person ever for combing through the sources of Chazal and citing everything else related to them, has the following comment. It's long, but it's a great one. And it is clear from the Yerushalmi what is meant by Afikomen, because it also quotes Rav there, that one doesn't move from one company to another. This is also the explanation of the Bavli. What does Afikomen mean? Said Rav, that they must not move from one company to another. And this is without a doubt the correct interpretation. For it is known that it was the ways and customs of Greeks to partake in a joyous feast. And when the partying had reached its peak, they would burst into houses and cajole the occupants to join them and continue the celebration there. This was called an epikomazin. And the Mishnah warns that the Pesach sacrifice should not be concluded with an epikoman. It Mishnaically Hebraicizes the Greek word. This, an afikomen, if you read it a different way, it's like, oh yeah, that's epikoman. Oh, that's a Greek word transliterated into Hebrew. This is the explanation given in both the Bavli and Yerushalmi that they must not move from one company to another. And as it's being explained correctly by the Achronim, this is understood by the Yerushalmi that defines afikomen as certain types of music. So even in the Yerushalmi, they debate somewhat the afikomen. But the Mishnah says, and again, we're not getting into the whole question of how much is the Seder modeled after the kind of Greco-Roman symposium, the kind of festive meal people would have, for which many things can be explained by appealing to that, but many things aren't. But fundamentally, the idea that Chazal modeled the Seder on something broader than just a regular meal is not a crazy idea. But whenever you are modeling something after what other people do, you have to draw a very clear line somewhere. And so Chazal and the Mishnah, the Tanaim and the Mishnah say, no epikomen, no, that's not what we're saying. You know, it's like shuls, you know, often have kind of events, you know, casino nights. Casino nights are popular things for shuls to say, shuls to have. But no one actually has to explicitly say this, but it's like, but you know, there's a line to how much of Las Vegas we are bringing to the shul. But you could imagine someone getting a bit too excited and getting a bit too carried away and thinking, oh, this is truly Las Vegas recreation, you know, and we have to draw a red line. So the Mishnah draws a very big red line here. You may be modeling yourselves after the Greeks, but no epikoman, no epikomazin, no getting up from one another. It's not a social. It's not a giant big, you know, let's all get together and talk to one another. That's not its purpose. That's what the Mishnah says. Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikomen. Even the language. After the Pesach has been eaten, you cannot, you know, exempt yourselves for an afikomen. But Chazal and the Bavli don't speak Greek. By the way, another example of Greek words comes up in Rosh Hashanah. The three explanations of what kivnei maron means. What does it mean we all pass like kivnei maron? So one answer is it's like sheep. One answer is it's like the place B'nai Maron, which was very thin. And one answer is it's a numeron. It's an army. We are gathered. God gathers us and counts us like an army. I spoke about this in my first Rosh Hashanah here. But again, it's another example of a, you know, a non-Hebrew word. I think it's Latin in that case, but it's a non-Hebrew Aramaic word being used by earlier generation of Chazal who all speak it. Whereas by the time you get to another group of people, they don't anymore. You know, it's like when you read Rav Soloveitchik and he uses the word Weltanschauung. And everyone's like, what's a Weltanschauung? No one knows what a Weltanschauung is because no one speaks German, but he did. So he uses it because he can't think of a good enough English word to use instead. Worldview. But he can't think of a good, but like, it doesn't quite capture it as well. So he uses it and then everyone's like, what is this? We don't know. We now have to look it up. But nowadays we can just ask someone who's German or use a dictionary. But in the days of Chazal, they didn't have that. So they had to try and figure it out from other things. So what we see at this point is that the Haggadah has really, really come together. By the time the Amoraim turn, by the time kind of the Gemara comes to a close, the Haggadah as we know it is more or less complete. The blatant things that are missing, the songs at the end, but they really aren't a part of the Haggadah. Like most of the Haggadah that we know it, barring the odd little flourish, is found already by the close of the Gemara. But that is not actually to say that that is what everyone was doing. Quite the opposite. If we just very quickly look at the next two sources, it's taken from the period of the Gaonim. The Gaonim follows straight after the close of the Gemara. Indeed, the very first Gaon was kind of, the best way to describe the period of the Gaonim is, It's the first group of people to treat the Gemara like a fixed text. Now it's closed. Now we cannot add anything to it anymore. Because, you know, there are the Savoraim come after the Amoraim, and they're constantly adding stuff and adding explanations and adding questions into the Gemara and answers. The Gaonim are the first people to come. Gaonim is Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. They were the Rosh Yeshiva of Bavel. They were the Rosh Yeshiva of the time. They were the Rosh Yeshiva of the same Yeshivat Chazal themselves had headed. But now we see the transformation in a lot of ways of the Jewish life. Source number 12 is amazing because it mentions so many different things. It's crazy, but let's read it and then process it. And thus says Rav Natronai, the head of the yeshiva. It's one of the Gaonim. Someone who says in the Kiddush of Pesach, Mekadesh Yisrael. And when he finishes Manish Tana, does not say Avadim Hayinu. He doesn't go straight from Manish Tana to Avadim Hayinu. And does not say Matchila of the Avodah Zara Hayu Avotenu, our forefathers worship idols. But says, and Joshua said to all the people, the beginning of that section that Rav is quoting, which we skip. But it begins in, say, you know, this is kind of the opening passage. It's Sefer Yehoshua, so he's speaking to the people. Up to, but Yaakov and his sons went down to Egypt. And from, blessed be he fulfills his promise, up to Tzeol Amad, and reads Arami Oved Avi until he finishes the entire passage. Only the verses, and does not say Midrash at all. And says Rabban Gabriel, and who redeemed us, and Hallel. This is very surprising. So there's a couple of things already to note here. He's describing stuff people are doing. So as much as we think the Haggadah is kind of, you know, by the time the Gemara ends, the Haggadah is known, clearly not, because he's getting really upset by people who are doing all of these things. A lot of these things, as a surprise point out in great detail, are points of contention in the Gemara and afterwards. What exactly are the brachot we make at Kiddush on Pesach night? When, you know, we don't say, you know, if you follow the Yerushalmi, this is something I forgot to mention, many manuscripts from Israel itself do not have Shmuel's view in the Haggadah, because Shmuel doesn't appear in the Yerushalmi. They only followed Rav, who says you begin Matchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu. You don't bother with Avadim Hayinu. Rav Natragon is speaking about people who do this, people who skip Shmuel's view. They do a slightly different version of Rav's view. All of this, and he describes an alternative Seder taking place, and it's upsetting him. What does he say about these people? Anyone who follows this custom, needless to say, has not only not fulfilled the mitzvah, but is also a heretic. That escalated quickly. Who rejects the words of the sages and disdains the words of the Mishnah and Talmud and all the communities must excommunicate him. Did the sages say that one should start with, and Joshua said to all the people? No. But from Matchila of the Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu, as we learn, and then he quotes source 6. So he's basically saying here, there may be variant traditions of what one is doing at Seder night, but along Chazal have come, and they've brought order, and they've codified it, and now you have to follow them, regardless of what your tradition is. Even if your tradition is from the land of Israel, which never incorporated the view of Shmuel into the Haggadah, you don't get to choose anymore, you have to do so. The people who observe the practices above are sectarians, and they mock the words of the sages, and are student of Anan, may his name rot, Karaites. Now, Karaites didn't do all this stuff at the Seder. As the Sefarais point out, we have a Karaite Haggadot, and they're a lot less exciting than ours. But his point is, you know, classic move, label the people you disagree with, you know, a different group of Jews entirely. But fundamentally, what this shows is that there are variant Haggadot out there. So even though our Haggadah nowadays is identical to, you know, as it has been for however long it's been, for a significant period of Jewish history, the Haggadah was still being crystallized. Different views were still being considered. People hadn't decided that Shmuel and Rav would both get equal, you know, real estate in the Haggadah. There were traditions that one would follow where you would just follow the view of Rav. As I mentioned last week, there was a very significant tradition for quite a long period of time that people would have roasted, you know, something at the Seder, which is now the biggest no-no in the world, but as a zecher of the Korban, to remember the Korban, the sacrifice. People would do that. Nowadays, that's a big no-no. But as much as we think kind of the Haggadah has been sealed already by the times of the Gemara, the frustration of the Gaonim shows that it's not so much. And another example of this is source number 13, which is in the Siddur of Rav Amram Gaon, one of the first people to write a Siddur. There is no need to say She'asa Nisim Lavotenu. So you think Purim and Chanukah, we say the bracha who made miracles for us, Bayamim Hahem Bazman Hazeh, in those days and in ours. Why don't we say this at the Seder? It seems the perfect time to recognize a miracle. Why? Because the Rosh Yeshiva said that the person saying Kiddush on Pesach does not have to say it over wine. And on Chanukah and Purim, we say the same blessing by itself because there is no Kiddush and no Haggadah and no order of miracles as on Pesach. The Gaonim have decided you don't make the bracha of She'asanisim Lavotenu because unlike Purim and Chanukah, which need something else to give them something, we have enough on Pesach. We don't need to, it's pretty evident from the Haggadah that we are praising God for the miracles he performed for us and our ancestors. And that is the minhag of two yeshivot, and the person saying this blessing is saying God's name in vain. In other words, people are doing this. Despite the fact that the Rashi Yeshiva have come out and said, don't do this, this is bad, people are nonetheless doing it. In the period right after the close of the Gemara, the Haggadah is still in flux. So as much as they speak of a Haggadah, as much as they speak of a Seder, as much as so many of the things that we do now at our Haggadah, almost all of them would be recognizable, back then, only by some people. If someone from the land of Israel, circa, 500 CE, were to walk in on your Seder, first of all, that would be terrifying, but were they to do so and you'd be cool with it, they'd be like, what's this Avadim Hayinu nonsense? Why would, who says we do that? Let alone all the other stuff that would mystify them, but if they got over all of that, they'd be confused by why we're doing this stuff. They'd start, a lot of these things that we think of and we take for granted of, things we do, we're still not always done in the times of the Gaonim. But nonetheless, what we've seen from the sources over the past 2 weeks is how we go from the times of the Torah, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, education and group, until the close of the Gemara where the Haggadah really starts to look like what it looks like today. And again, let's not take that for granted because so many of the things we do aren't this complete by the close of the Gemara. Most of the things we do are far from this complete in the times of the Gemara. And yet, this is. If you think of the Siddur in contrast, that's not going to be complete for a long, long time yet, historically. But the Haggadah already begins to take shape. But what we're going to look at next week is how the Haggadah is more than just a text that's kind of evolved throughout history. It's also one of the strongest articulators of Jewish philosophy and takes very hardline views on some really key aspects. And so we will explore that next week. And at the same time, we will also take a look at maybe the most famous custom we do at Pesach, which is Dam, Tzefardeya, Kinim. And we dip it. And why do we dip it? Because we are shedding a proverbial tear for the people who, for the Egyptians who died. That's a 20th century reason. As we will see next week, the original reasons for doing that custom are maybe to our 21st century eyes far more disturbing and far more vengeful. But what we'll kind of explore is this idea that in the 20th century, we decided we don't like the reason for a custom. Let's completely change the reason. And we're all like, sure, let's roll with it. And we all did it because we didn't like it any other way. And so we'll focus on those two things next week. And once again, in Shabbat HaGadol, we'll take a deeper dive into the Arba Banim and try and figure out exactly who they are, what they are, and where they come from, and what lessons we learn from it.